Has anybody ever done like the SeaWorld thing, swimming with dolphins or anything like that, or been close to dolphins? I've never done the SeaWorld thing, but dolphins are amazing, amazing creatures. They're these beautiful, majestic creatures. Some people say dolphins are some of the smartest animals in the world. If you want to feel a little less smart, you know, you University of Kentucky students, dolphins actually have bigger brains than humans do. Yet on this occasion, these dolphins obviously clearly did, you know, something super foolish. I don't know if it was just following the pack, or I think dolphins are called pods, right? Are they called pods? It's a group of dolphins, not a herd, a pack, it's a pod. So they came together, this little pod just comes up rushing on the beach. But the problem is that dolphins aren't meant to live on the beach. You know, I saw someone, because YouTube comments are just kind of irresistible sometimes, in the comments was like, abort, abort, you know, the mission is a failure, you know, and they all went charging forward. But they were not meant to live in that shallow a depth. And the reason I show that video, because those dolphins put their lives at risk and they had people saving them there, they put their lives at risk being in such shallow waters, is that tonight I want us to talk about the ways in which we actually put our very lives at risk as well by heading into shallow waters. And whether it's following other people like the dolphins follow the other dolphins, we are in danger of drowning ourselves in the shallow waters. Or as Nicholas Carr calls our times in his 2011 book, it's one of this fabulous, most fabulous book titles. You don't even need to read the book, so I'm going to go ahead and spoil it for you, but you can just read the title. The title of the book is called The Shallows, and the subtitle is What the Internet is doing to our brains. And so tonight, we were asked to talk, and people were just saying, hey, I would love to have CSF have a conversation about technology. Technology is just all pervasive. It surrounds us. It's everywhere we go. Just a show of hands, I don't actually have mine on me, although I would raise my hand as well. It was in when I walked in the building. Now it's laying back on my desk. Who has a cell phone on them? Just curious. Is there anyone who doesn't have a cell phone on them? I'm just curious. I didn't even think to ask that question. Not a single person. Wow, that is amazing. So, 100% of people here, we have technology. We are surrounded by technology. And in some ways, you know, it's a key conversation. We talk about these key conversations that we need to have. And one of the reasons I think we need to have it in here is because we probably don't have it elsewhere. We just kind of take it as like the air we breathe, right? You didn't think about, probably none of us made a choice tonight. I know I didn't make a conscious choice when I left the house tonight. When I walked out, I just was like, you know, keys, wallet, phone. That's kind of my ritual. Keys, wallet, phone. I have my wallet, I have my keys, I got my phone. And now I've just started where I keep credit cards. Anybody else do that on their phone? So I don't even have to carry a wallet with me most of the time anymore. I just have keys and phone, and it's got credit cards in it, and I'm fine. And so we are surrounded by this. But the question becomes, what is this constant access to technology doing to us, and why does it matter for us to talk about here tonight? Philip Yancey. Philip Yancey is a well-known Christian writer. Anybody ever read any Philip Yancey books? The Jesus I Never Knew, What's So Amazing About Grace? If you were ever kind of like, man, what in the world? What is God's grace about? Philip Yancey was an award-winning book called What's So Amazing About Grace. He's written tons of books. In his personal library, he talks about having 5,000 books. 5,000 personal books. And he was writing a piece for the Washington Post, interacting with Nicholas Carr's book, The Shallows, and What's the Internet? What's technology doing to our brains? And Philip Yancey said, hey, I have 5,000 books in my personal library. For many years, I would try to read 3 books every single week. He said, one year, just for fun, I decided in the evening, one evening a week, I would sit down and read the entire works of all Shakespeare's plays. Just for fun. He said, this is what I do. I love to read. I love to have books. But he said, I've noticed something. He said, when I'm writing and I'm talking about this, I'm talking about a life I used to have. Because he said, in recent years, you know, I was like, hey, I'm going to go get an iPhone. Everybody's got iPhones. These are cool ways to stay in touch with people and all the media devices and everything that we have. And he said, no longer can I read 3 books a week. He said, it's hard for me. Sometimes he said, and you guys have probably been this. I know as soon as I read Philip Yancey saying this, I was like, I've done this. You ever get through like a piece on the internet and you're reading, you're interested in it, but you kind of look over the side to see how long is this? Do y'all do that? You're reading, you're like, okay, this is fun, but is this going to take me more than like 2.5 minutes to read? Because if it is, I'm gonna save it for later and come back to it, which, you know, you never do, or at least I never do. But Philip Yancey said, instead of doing deep dives into words and into books, exploring the depths of the oceans, now I merely jet ski across the surface of ideas and conversations. And it's not just Philip Yancey who's catching on to this and realizing something's different. Many, many people are starting to catch on to this. Adam Alter is a guy, he wrote a book called Irresistible, The Rise of Addictive Technologies and the Business of Keeping Us Hooked. This is what he said in a conversation. It's a really fascinating thing. I actually met a kid on a ski lift in Montana who goes to one of these schools. They're called the Waldorf schools, but listen to this. He says, this is Alter talking about technology and how people are starting to realize things are changing. It's actually shaping our lives. Says there's a school in Silicon Valley that doesn't allow the use of any tech. It's called the Waldorf School. And it's fascinating because the school has no computers, no iPads, no iPhones. They try to minimize tech altogether. And so people enjoy a lot of face-to-face time. They go outside a lot. What's interesting about this school in Silicon Valley is 75% of the students there are children of Silicon Valley tech execs, which is striking. These are people who publicly will expound on the wonders of the products they're producing. And at the same time, they decided in all their wisdom that their kids didn't belong in a school that used the same technology. You know, if you were building buildings in America, certainly from the 1930s up in even to the 1970s, there was a substance that was used in almost every building that was built, especially if it was a public, it was a commercial building. It was used, the substance was used because people thought, man, this is a fabulous technological improvement in how we can build buildings. It was really lightweight, and so it added to the strength of steel and structures without adding a lot of weight. So it was cost effective. It was fire retardant, so that, you know, a lot of commercial buildings had to worry about fire issues and getting people out safely before the building would go up in flames too quickly. And so it was this wonderful, wonderful substance that people used. And it was used, as one person said, he said, this chemical was used in almost every public and commercial building constructed before the 1980s in the United States. The chemical, the product, asbestos. We used this wonder material, but eventually we figured out that although it had good qualities, the health risks far outweighed the helpful benefits. Nick Byton is a writer for the New York Times. And a few years ago, he had written about the iPad and was getting, you know, when the iPad first came out, and he did one of the first big tech reviews of the iPad, this in-depth tech review. And one of the workers, one of the workers who was in the tech industry called him, and they were talking about it. And he asked this guy, he said, hey, what do your kids think of the iPad? And this is what this particular worker said. He said, the iPad, they haven't used it. We limit how much technology our kids use at our home. My kids accuse me and my wife of being fascists and being overly concerned about tech. And they say that none of their friends have the same rules. That's because we've seen the dangers of technology firsthand. Not the gangers. I just realized that. And we've seen the gangers, you know, who roll up, you know, and flash gang signs of technology. So much for, spell checking slides. We have seen the dangers of technology firsthand. I've seen, and this is key, I've seen it in myself, and I don't want to see that happen to my kids. I've seen it in myself, and I don't want to see it happen to my kids. My kids don't use iPads. We strictly limit their use of technology. You know who said that? Steve Jobs, founder of Apple, CEO of Apple when the iPad was released. I remember talking to Damps, our beloved brother, who now may he rest in peace in Austin. I remember talking to Damps and DK, who was up here last week, Derek. I don't know, when he finishes his PhD, I just don't know if I'm going to be able to call him Dr. King. But I remember a few years ago talking to Damps and DK, and we had this conversation. And, you know, I thought maybe I was just beginning to lose my mind a little bit and thought, you know, we just randomly kind of fell into this conversation. I said, have you noticed, and this is a few years into the iPhone era, you know, the iPhone's been out now, what, 2007, about 12 years. And this is probably 5-6 years ago, and I said, have you noticed, like, I can't remember what I read as much as I used to. I used to be able to read something that was kind of locked in pretty well. I mean, I certainly didn't have photographic memory, but I had a good memory. I could recall, hey, this page, this idea, this sort of thing. And I said, I've noticed I'm not quite as sharp on remembering everything as I used to. And you know, Damps and DK, who are both really bright guys, they said, I've noticed the exact same thing. as we started talking about it, I said, yeah, you know, I've noticed the more I use my cell phone, the less I pick up, you know, real books. And the more I read stuff on my cell phone, I don't tend to remember it as much. It might be a good article, but then, you know, a day or two later, I'm like, what was that article about? I kind of remember reading something. And without getting too much into the research here, and this is one of the dangers of tonight, I was even back in my office just cutting things, is because I'm actually, a couple of us here are actually working on a book on this, on technology and what's a Christian response to technology. And so I have this massive amount of data and things like this and trying to pare it down. But with that, so without getting too deeply into this, three things that current popular digital technology it does to us that you might not realize at first is it lessens your ability, what I just mentioned, it lessens your ability to retain information. It literally rewires your brain. It messes with your brain chemistry. When you use, you know, iPhone, you use apps on your phone. I don't know if you're aware of this or not, but a lot of the most popular apps that you all have on your phones, they actually employ addiction specialists to create addiction for you. So they find people who actually know, you know, about addiction, know how to create addiction, and then they go out and employ those people and hire them to say, hey, how can I make this the most literally biochemically addictive? If you've ever said, I feel like I'm addicted to my phone, you probably actually are. That every time you get a like button, every time, you know, someone smashes the like button, anything like that, as Steven said, I think that's the first time I've ever used that phrase. But, you know, anytime someone does that, there is actually a little dopamine hit that you get because it's like, oh, someone liked it. What happened? Somebody likes what I'm doing. There is actually brain chemistry stuff that's going on that is literally rewiring your brain that is not making you smarter. Second thing it does is it kills your attention span. I know someone who, after a few years of being on a cell phone technology, he went and he said, hey, something's going on with my mind. And he literally even thought, he said, I thought I was having an early onset of dementia. And he said he went to a specialist to get tested for some things. And they were testing him. And one of the things they gave him was this kind of personality test. And when he got the results back, they gave him an IQ test in the process. He said, I literally tested as a genius. This guy's fairly bright. And he said, I literally tested in the IQ level of genius. But he said, my attention span, when they measured out just for attention, my IQ when it came to attention was at the level of, you'd laugh at it, but mental adult retardation. So he was a genius overall, but he couldn't hold his attention. And his cell phone, in part, and other things had just worked to fry his mind and kill his attention span. The third thing that maybe you're not aware of, again, so much data is out there, social media. Social media users report way more anxiety. A recent study of over 1 million, so this is not a small study, over 1 million high schoolers in America showed that clearly that people who spent more time on phones and social media and technology of this nature were less psychologically healthy across the board than people who spent less time, that it was a clear predictor of anxiety and other psychological disorders. But here's the thing, more than your brain, and there is a, you know, one of the great gifts God's given us is our brains, but more than just your cognitive abilities tonight, I'm concerned about something even bigger. I'm concerned about something even deeper. I'm concerned about your soul, which is to say, I'm concerned about you at the deepest levels of who you are. Honestly, I'm concerned about myself because I know I have a cell phone. I have an iPhone. I don't use my social media accounts much. I do have them, though, and I feel the beck and call sometimes when I'm bored to just kind of scroll through and look at these things. I'm concerned about your soul. I'm concerned about my soul. I'm concerned about the soul of the world, and as a dad with three kids, I'm concerned about them and the world in which they're growing up. You know, Jeremiah is an Old Testament prophet. We just heard his words in Jeremiah 6 just a few minutes ago. He's an Old Testament prophet, and what he's trying to do is he's trying to get the people of Israel to turn back to God. The people have deserted God. There's a lot of powerful stuff in the book of Isaiah. It can be a little tricky to read at points, but there's so much powerful stuff in there about the horror of what life looks like without God, but also about the goodness of what life can be like when we do follow God. And that is one of the key themes that CSF has hit over the course of many, many years, is that life at its best is following God. Life at its best is living with this awareness that, man, we are not just meant for space and time. We're not just, you know, beings created for this world. Man, we are beings made for eternity, that God has made us with unbelievable depths. And when we follow God, we open ourselves up to that. Blessings follow, goodness flows. I'm not talking cash and life of luxury, but goodness flows. Life at its best is following God. But something has happened to us. Something's happened to us in our culture that we can't even sustain. You know, think about all the different things, all the different social media kind of buzzes and stuff that come through. And you could probably think of different things and that you think, hey, well, this movement and that movement, everybody was posting about this for about 3 weeks. And then it just kind of it seems like we cannot hold our attention on anything. It seems like we are drowning in the shallows. Or as one writer, Neil Postman, liked to say, we are amusing ourselves to death. We're amusing ourselves to death. To amuse, I don't know if you know what that literally means, to amuse. And again, there's nothing wrong with laughter. I love to laugh. Class clown voted in my high school class. I love laughter. I love being silly. But when you amuse, it literally means to stop thinking. To muse is to think. To amuse is to stop thinking. We are amusing ourselves to death. We don't want to live in this wide awareness, but we were made for this wide world with God. We're made to live. Yes, the current moment matters, but we're made to live in this wider, larger backdrop of all time and history of eternity. But we don't ever give that consideration in so many parts of our lives. We're caught up in the moment of a secular age, the current moment, and the deep parts of our lives are shut off, and they die and wither due to inattention. And yet here comes the words of Jeremiah. And Jeremiah says again, he says, this is what the Lord says. Stop at the crossroads. Stop. Just stop. Put down the podcast, as good as it may be. Put down the worship songs, as good as it may be. Put down, you know, whatever it is that's distracting your attention. Stop at the crossroads and look around. And ask God for the old, as the NIV says, the ancient ways. Ask for the old godly ways and then begin to walk in them. Travel its paths and you'll find rest for your soul. But you reply, that's not the road we want. Or as one friend of mine recently commented about this, he said, we've got iPhones, who needs God? Now, of course, we don't say that. No one would ever really say that and really mean it, or you know, at least probably a lot of us in here wouldn't say that, but that's how we live. We don't need really the deep things of God because we've got an iPhone to keep us distracted. Psalm 42 says, deep calls to deep in the roar of your waterfalls. All your waves and breakers have swept over me. By day, the Lord directs his love. At night, his song is with me, a prayer to the God of my life. There are depths in us. There is a soul. We are soul. My fear tonight for us isn't so much that we'd openly disobey God, though that's always a risk and it's always a perennial issue in all of our lives, including mine. But my bigger fear tonight isn't so much we'd openly disobey God, is that we would just simply forget God. I mean, what do I need the song of the Lord, as the psalmist says, to sing over me at night when I've got Netflix to just kind of help me kind of drift off to sleep and wake up and start it all again the next day? Pope Francis recently wrote this, and he says, when media and the digital world become omnipresent, their influence can stop people from learning how to live wisely, to think deeply, and to love generously. In this context, the great sages of the past run the risk of going unheard amid the noise and distractions of an information overload. This overload leads to a confusion, a sort of mental pollution. In other words, we need the old voices. We need to live in deeper waters than the current moment. I love the 4th century saint John Chrysostom. He had one of the great nicknames of all time in church history. He was nicknamed the Golden Mouth. And it was because he was just this great orator and people would come from miles around to hear him preach. But Chrysostom was famous for admonishing the people in his congregation there to not go to the theater. To not go to the Roman theaters in this time and place. And part of it, sure, had to do with, you know, just kind of the debauchery, the things that, you know, you might see in these live-action theaters in those days. But another part of it, was Chrysostom said, is that it deadened them. It deadened them. And I love the phrase. It said it created dead spots in the people's spiritual sensitivities. And it lessened the nerves of their zeal. They didn't hunger for God as much because they were simply going to the theater one or two nights a week. What in the world would Chrysostom, the great saint, the great preacher, the great care of people's souls, what would he say to our souls when he was worried about people going one or two nights to the theater, when he couldn't even imagine something like an iPhone, 24 hours a day, strapped to our bodies, or certainly within reach? The old voices are what we need. We were made for depths. We were made for a life deeper than Twitter and Instagram can offer us. Jesus gave us the Beatitudes, right? Some of you may know this, the blessings, you know, where blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called children of God. And so I thought tonight it might be helpful for us to come up with a few blessings as we think about technology and how our lives work in it. A few Beatitudes, a few blessings for our digital age. And so let me just give you a few of these. Some are from my own, some are from some other people who helped me craft some of these. The first, blessed are the flip phoners, for they shall inherit a brain and an attention span. Blessed are the social media abstainers, for they will miss out on FOMO. Blessed are those without headphones or earbuds, for they will hear God. Blessed are those that lose their phones, for they will find their friends. It's good. That may be my favorite. Blessed are those who trade the novel for the novel, for they will find knowledge. Good, yeah. Blessed are those who quit Netflix, for they will find rest. Blessed are those who are persecuted for quitting social media, because they'll never hear their persecutors. Good. Blessed are people who read physical books, for they shall remember what they read and have retinas still intact at the age of 35. That was mine. Blessed are you when you put down your phone to have a conversation with a real human, for in these encounters, love grows best. And on, the blessings continue to go. John Tyson is a pastor. I know some of you here listen to him. In fact, I think the CSF community was maybe some of the people around it who introduced me to John Tyson. John Tyson's a pastor out of New York City. I just heard recently in one of his most recent sermons, he said he's actually doing an entire year of a digital fast, a media fast, as much as he possibly can. But John Tyson, I know when we were interviewing him at a CSF gathering earlier this semester, John Tyson said, and I love the quote that he had, he said, iPhones, you know, cell phones, smartphones, they're great tools. You can do a lot of really cool things with them, but they're horrible masters. Great tools, but horrible masters. And let me be clear, I don't want to be a legalist. Do not hear me saying that if you have a cell phone, I have a cell phone, I have social media accounts, again, I don't use them very much, but that if you have those things, you cannot have a soul, or that you are displeasing to God, or you're just, you know, you're in sin or something because you have these things. That's not what I'm saying. I do not want to be a legalist about this, but what I do want to say, and what I want to make a note and strike a note for tonight, is that I do think these things are sucking us. Our culture is sucking us into shallow waters. It's sucking us into just living in the current moment, moment by moment, from Instagram post to Instagram post. And we don't live with this deep awareness of what God is doing in the world and what he wants to do in us. And we're like those dolphins who are just being led into the shallowness, thinking they're headed towards some exciting adventure when really they're headed towards their death. When you look at what tech offers us, when you look at what tech offers us and what our soul desires, you can clearly see when you line them up that they're really in juxtaposition, because when what tech offers us is distraction. What our soul desires is rest. What tech offers us is anxiety, is that as studies clearly show, including that million high schoolers that were recently surveyed, it offers us anxiety. What our soul desires is peace. Tech offers us a sedentary life. What our soul desires is life as an adventure. It offers us sexual disorder. Technology, what we crave in our souls is sexual intimacy. It offers us isolation, but our soul desires community. And so in closing tonight, to try to think about this key topic of technology, and again, all of us here, every single person in this room, and I'm going to assume back in the Columbia room as well, said, I have, you know, I don't know who's got a concealed carry in here. If you do, probably don't even tell me. But we are all packing tonight, right? We're packing our cell phones with us. But so what would I say? And I've got a baker's dozen pieces of pastoral advice as someone who is trying very unsuccessfully in some days to grow a soul. As someone who's trying to do this, as someone who's trying to raise kids, and actually that's the focus of the book that I'm working towards writing, is on for parents. Because I see so many parents struggling to raise kids in this age, and especially, you know, young kids like mine. Here's the baker's dozen, the 13 pieces of quick advice, the pastoral advice that I would give you on technology. First, I would say, take a digital Sabbath. take a digital Sabbath. I know one guy who actually used to be a campus minister at Harvard by the name of Andy Crouch. He wrote a short little book called The TechWise Family. And Andy Crouch says for him and his family, his kids, he said they practice digital Sabbath this way. He said they do 1 hour a day where they just put all their cell phones off. They turn off all kind of technology. And they just said, we read books. We play the piano. We go for hikes. We do these things 1 hour a day, 1 day per week. We just say, you know, we're going to limit, you know, as in all sensible ways, we're going to limit technology 1 day per week. And then 1 week per year, where you just say, hey, we're going to try and do social media fast. We're going to do cell phone fast, all this, 1 hour per day, 1 day per week, one week per year. He said, our cell phones in our house, we go to bed before our cell phones. We put them to bed. There's a place literally we put our cell phones to bed, Andy says, in our house, and we get up before they do. They can keep going and going and going. They don't tire. They don't need rest like we do. And so take a digital Sabbath is the first thing I'd say. The second thing I'd say is that is just be distracted less. Be distracted less. You know, one of the things, if you have to practice, if you do have your cell phone there, one of the things I've been trying to do more and more in my life is if I do have my cell phone there, I just keep it face down. Because, right, we've all been distracted where it lights up or, you know, whatever. I turned off as many buzzes as I could because even, you know, if my phone's on silent there for a long time, you know, if I got a text, it would still buzz. I'd hear, oh, okay, somebody just texted me. Even if it was on silent, it was still letting me know. So put as many things on silent as you can. Put it down. Be distracted less. Be present in the moment. I would say third, don't take it to your room. Don't take it to your room at night. That's something that I've had, and I'm renewing for several months. I was practicing this, had some friends holding me accountable to it as well. In fact, I was texting a group of guys in this Bible study small group that I was in at the time, and I texted a group of guys, said, hey, I just want your all's accountability that I don't want to take my cell phone into my bedroom past 8 o'clock. And one of the guys texted me off to the side and out of the group and texted me personally. He said, hey, are you struggling with porn? And I was like, no, I'm not. Thanks for asking. That's an inbounds question here. That's fine. But no, I'm not. It has nothing to do with porn. I'm not struggling at all with that. I just don't want this distraction. I want to have, you know, conversations with my wife, because there were definitely nights where my cell phone addiction is chess. I love to play online chess on my phone. I know it's super nerdy. But need I remind you that I have a third grader at home who can beat every single one of you at chess. And so I'm trying to keep up with him. And my wife multiple times has told me while we're laying in bed, she'll want to have a conversation and I'll say, hey, I'm in the middle of a game. My time's running low. Can we wait till afterwards? And her standard reply is, quote, I'm praying you lose. So it's a wonderful marriage we have. So don't take it. That's piece number three. Don't take it in your room past 8 o'clock. Certainly if porn's an issue, then all the more. Fourth, favor the human over the digital. Favor the human over the digital. If you can call somebody, call them. You know, I mean, there are some times where it's better to actually call than to text. If you can go be with somebody, don't just FaceTime with them. Favor the human over the digital. Five, spend time. This is key. Spend time with God in silence. Podcast sermons are great. I love listening to great podcasts. I love listening to sermons. Like, I know a lot of you listen to worship music and various things on your devices, but yet there is something to be said about just being in silence with God to hear that still small voice that speaks sometimes. Listen to good sermons and podcasts. Listen to, you know, worship music, but also take time to spend time in silence. Six, read difficult books. Read books that you feel like are a little challenging. Obviously, you have to do that with school, but find things that challenge you in your faith as well that maybe aren't the easiest things, but you go, God, it just seems like you've used this book in a lot of other people's lives. Seven, read in groups. Don't just read alone. Be a part of a group. Eight, go outside. Hike in creation. Use your body. You were given one by God. Use it. Number nine, spend, and maybe this is maybe most importantly of all, if you're looking for a place to start in all this, spend daily quiet time with God. Study the scriptures. That's a first antidote to saying, I want to listen. I want to live in some deeper waters. Then dive into the deep waters of Scripture of God. Number 10, keep a prayer journal. keep some that you just write out in a notebook and you just go, hey, I'm just going to write these prayers and see what God does with them. Don't feel like you've got to sound fancy or anything. I remember, you know, when I was in college thinking, oh man, somebody's going to, you know, read these someday and they're going to turn these into a book and, you know, they're going to be such great, wonderful prayers. And now I've just given up on all that. And I just write freely and like think, okay, maybe my kids might read this someday, but that's about it. And so, but just write a prayer journal and feel free. Number 11, be a part of a group Bible study, like a core group. That's one of the reasons we stress being a part of a group at CSF is because it gives you the chance to be in face-to-face human interactions. It is such a powerful thing that amazingly our culture lacks. There is so much loneliness. Be in a group. Number 12, be accountable. Ask deep, soulish questions of your friends. It is so easy. It's so easy, even at a place like CSF, even with friends who you know, man, they're trying to follow God, I'm trying to follow God. And yet, you know, the conversations just stay in the shallows. They stay there. You talk about sports, you talk about movies, you know, whatever it is, you talk about those things. Ask deep, soulish questions of your friends. It doesn't mean you have to do that all the time and you have to be the, you know, kind of the wet blanket. Okay, here they come. They're going to ask, you know, whatever. I'm not saying be the, you know, then you just become the social leper. But do find moments. This is key. Find moments of risk to ask those deep, soulish questions. And I would say this of you, answer deep, soulish questions from your friends. And that leads to the baker's dozen, the 13th one. If you don't have friends who ask you deep, soulish questions, find some. Find some. Ask deep, soulish questions of them. Let them ask you deep, soulish questions. We need to turn to the old ways. We live in absolutely incredible, incredible times. Talking to friends who, and maybe some of you, I know we've got the awkward middle school dance coming on, tomorrow night. Talking to friends who, people who have been around the educational circles for a while, they say the middle school dance of yesteryear is not what we remember it. I mean, I remember my awkward middle school dance moment of this girl, Christy. I'm not going to give her last name, hopefully, in this story, because you guys have messed up on that before. But I just remember, like, I knew she wanted to dance with me. But I'm like an eighth grade, super, you know, I'm outgoing. But yet when it came to the girl, I was just like, oh, I can't ask her to dance. I know she wants to. And finally, the last song, I finally worked up the nerve to ask her to dance. But I just stood over there awkwardly all night waiting to dance with Christy. But, you know, the way the middle school teachers tell me now that middle school dances are just people looking at their cell phones the entire time. The world has changed in crazy, crazy ways. Soak yourselves in the scripture. Present yourselves to God in prayer. Spend time daily worshiping. Have a soul. No, don't have a soul. You have an Instagram account, most of you. You have whatever apps you have on your devices. You have a lot of things. You don't have a soul. You are a soul. You are a soul, and you are a loved, grace-infused, God-forgiven soul. Grow that soul, because your life, and maybe even the life of others, depends on it. Let's pray. Lord Jesus, you have shaped us. You have made us for the deep parts of the oceans of this world. You have made us to live in depths. And yet, God, so many times we are content to live, as Nicholas Carr says, in the shallows. God, I pray that you would give us that, as the psalmist says, the deep would call to deep, that even tonight as we sing these last few songs, that your spirit would just call deeper into us to say, we were made for depths with you. God, that we would be people, and in some ways, all we have to do to live radically in this culture is just to acknowledge that we're not just Instagram account maintainers. We're not just iPhone owners. We are people with soul. And the people that we encounter every day are people of soul. And so God, I just pray that you would move us to be people of depths, whatever we fear in those depths, Lord, and I know there are things to fear. There are deep, dark parts of the ocean that we can't imagine, and we're scared of creatures that lurk there. But Lord, we also confess that you are a good Father, and that whatever the depths of this world, and it is a fallen world with hurts and scary things in it, but God, you go with us. And so, Lord, I pray for these students, I pray for myself, I pray for the staff, I pray that we would be people of depth. And so, Lord, just come and carve out just a bit more depth in our souls as we sing here tonight. We pray these things in your good and strong name, Jesus.